Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis, and this is a different type of show. We are not going to be talking about anyone's book, per se. We're going to be talking about what's happening in the world and how people can understand it better. With what happened in Paris and it's happening all over the world, former FBI agent Mike Tablin is here to clarify anything that needs to be clarified as far as what terrorism is, what a terrorist is, and how we can all learn to stay safe. So good morning, Mike. How are you?
Good morning, friend. Nice to be back with you.
Nice to be back with you. Thank you for doing this.
Sure.
If you had to define the word terrorism or terrorist, how would you define them so that people understand?
You know, that's a great question, Fran. I taught a class in terrorism in a college class online last year, and one of the big issues the students had trouble understanding is just what constitutes terrorism. You know, and I know in the public people say, well, how come that crime wasn't classified as terrorism or charged terrorism? So let me just kind of read a couple of definitions. If you go to the dictionary, you would hear that terrorism is the use of violence and threats to intimidate or coerce, especially for political purposes. All right, pretty straightforward. The United Nations has its own definition of terrorism. Criminal acts intended to provoke a state of terror in the general public. A group of persons, particularly for political purposes, are in any circumstance unjustifiable, whatever the consideration, and so on. The Department of Defense has its own definition. The unlawful use of violence or threat of violence, often motivated by religion, political, or other ideological beliefs, to instill fear and coerce governments. And then, you know, CIA has their own definition, I'm sure, and the State Department, all because we have different goals of what we're trying to accomplish in terms of how to fight terrorism, whether it's gathering intelligence. The State Department might be doing it from international affairs perspective. But when I look at it, and most people here in the United States look at it, we kind of have to define terrorism by the United States Code, which is the federal criminal law of the United States, the federal law. And within that code, it gets a little more confusing because they provide definitions of international terrorism and domestic terrorism, similar to what we hear about, which is to, you know, instill fear, create a state of terror, as the name implies. But we have to go by statute, and that's how I look at it as a former FBI agent, by how we're going to actually prosecute the criminality of terrorism. So we have international terrorism, which would be certain criminal acts as defined by federal statute that transcend national boundaries. So, for example, you know, if we look at 9/11, that would be international terrorism. It was planned outside the United States. They traveled outside the United States and traveled in the United States to commit the act within the United States. Then we get into towards domestic terrorism. And I know the issue came up recently. The FBI director was criticized because a mass shooting, he said, was not terrorism. And I said, oh, but it's terror. It creates fear. Yes, any mass shooting, you know, in any kind of facility, whether it's religious, you know, place of leisure, is going to create fear. But under the federal statutes, no one is actually prosecuted as a domestic terrorist. You have to commit a specific act, and such would be like the use of a weapon of mass destruction, as we saw in the Boston Marathon bombers. They're charged with specific acts under, you know, the auspices of domestic terrorism. So it gets people a little confused as to why something's a terrorism more than not, but there's adequate statutes to prosecute people who engage in those kind of acts, irrespective of how we label them. Did I answer the question in more words than necessary?
No, I think I finally understand it, yeah. But unfortunately, there are so many different definitions of the word terrorist also, and there are so many different terrorist groups out there. So what is the definition of a terrorist? Who are the top ones that we are concerned about, if not more? And how are they the same and how are they different in their thinking? And they're all dangerous.
They're all dangerous, exactly. Well, if we were to look at, you know, the terrorist groups now, you know, in the top of our mind, and different agencies may have different, you know, sort of rankings for them, you know, who are the most dangerous in terms of what's going on at the moment. And I can tell you within the, you know, the intelligence and law enforcement community, who, you know, usually who's ever the newest, you know, whoever pops up usually becomes the latest and greatest threat. So not maybe necessarily based on this, you know, algorithm. But certainly if we have to think of terrorist groups right now, we'll think mostly of ISIL, or sometimes known as ISIS, the Islamic State, of Iraq and Levant, or of Iraq and Syria. And they're very powerful. Again, they kind of crept up, sort of under our noses, filling some voids out there in the Middle East. And they believe in strict Sharia law and the Islamic Caliphate. And they're claiming territory and sort of a homeland, so to speak, in their own land. And they're using very violent, as we know, military and terrorist tactics to accomplish their goal. They're very powerful. And as you see, we're having trouble on a national level, on the worldwide level, of just how to address it.
Yeah, how do you?
This is where internally, from the law enforcement perspective, we do what we keep doing. We run our terrorist investigations. We try to track those who become ISIS sympathizers and make sure that if they start planning any criminal acts, we're on top of it. Always have to balance privacy versus law enforcement. We have to predicate our investigation on somebody before we become too intrusive. That's domestically. Then we have on the national front, I'm sorry, the international front, rather, you have to have the intelligence operations. You have to have NSA intercepting their communications, right? We always hear about the chatter. You know, that's communications that our intelligence agencies are intercepting. We have to have human intelligence, though. And I think if someone's asking where are we lacking mostly in our fight on terrorism, it'd be on human intelligence. Not just ISIL, but on the other terrorist organizations, you have to have informants in there. You have to be able to infiltrate these organizations to know exactly what they're doing. If we're not already engaging the Israelis, we should probably be doing that. They are masters.
I think so, too. You're right.
Human intelligence. Yeah, they have managed to always turn high-ranking officials to cooperate. You know, in their enemies, Hamas, Hezbollah, the PLO. That's why they've been, very effective. Nothing foolproof, obviously, but they've turned high-ranking members. They're masters of what they do. One time when I was in the FBI, I was privileged to sit in on a class from a Mossad agent kind of discussing, things they do to get that. They're fascinating. They have a science behind it. And if we're not engaging them, we should. But that's easier said than done. And let me just throw that out there. It's not an easy task to just go out there and do that. It's easy for me to speak about it. But I think we need to really focus on that, because when you have human intelligence and you know what the people are saying, that's the best form. Then you know where to go to continue your intercepts. So, for example, I've been asked many times when I'm doing with the media, what went wrong in Paris? What were we missing? I think what we were missing was a human intelligence, because we don't need to know everything, but we need to know one thing. We need to have a starting point. So if we knew about one of those terrorists and we were able to track him when he entered any part of the passport-free zone in Europe, if we were able to track him, just by physical surveillance, we would have known he was using a burner cell phone, most likely. We would have found other people he was talking to, so those would have been co-conspirators. We would have known what room he was staying in. That would have been a target for, again, a wire interception. What car he was driving, again, another target to, bug the car and hear what's going on. They have to communicate, but we just need to know where to get started, and that was the problem in Paris. We didn't have a starting point. We weren't alerted. And by we, I mean the intelligence communities together, not just Paris, but all of us together. We didn't have a starting point. So that's what I think is missing, better human intelligence to help us focus than the other intelligence, the signal intelligence and communication intelligence and our law enforcement activities.
So if we had human intelligence, you think that could have been prevented?
Oh, I think there's a much better chance it would have been prevented, yes. My experience in working, in the terrorism cases in the FBI, the criminal cases, against the mob and drug trafficking organizations, they're criminal organizations. They engage in violent acts, a little different mode and different what they're trying to accomplish, but the theory is not that much different on how we attack them. They're criminal enterprises, and we attack them by knowing what they're doing and then stopping them before they do it.
Let's hope that we can do that before they do it again.
Right, and that's what we try to do. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Why did they target Paris?
Well, they could have targeted any city.
Were these three places, were they considered soft targets?
Well, the actual places, the stadium, the concert hall, I think it was a restaurant, these are soft targets that probably 99% of the targets that you could target anywhere in the world are soft targets.
Yeah.
And there really is no practical way to protect everyone. I mean, even if we protect this stadium today, they could pick another venue similar to a stadium. There's always going to be gatherings of innocent people somewhere. And no matter how much you try to secure something, there's always a vulnerability. So you could have a stadium, and you could put a perimeter around the stadium, you know, blockage, and have people walk through metal detectors. And you could keep that stadium secure inside. But what do you have outside? You have people gathering to get in. And, you know, at some point, you know, is where the, you know, the inner perimeter and the outer perimeter meet, and you don't have security on one side of it. So there's always a vulnerability, and there is just no way to secure every soft target, you know, realistically, and nor is there a way to carry on our lives, you know, trying to secure every soft target.
Now, what would happen, it just bothers me, I guess, because restaurants, I could see where they can come in and just blow everybody away. But in a place like a concert hall or a stadium, could it have been somebody that was working there?
It could have been, but again, it depends on the security.
That's what I'm saying.
Were they metal detecting everybody? I don't know. No, they do. I know some places I go to, just locally, you know, they'll put you through a metal detector. Most places not. Again, we're trying to enjoy our lives. Most of the free society does not want a police state and be frisked and have to empty your pockets everywhere you go and, you know, get groped. You know, in other countries, you know, in Israel, I've seen that. You know, they have armed guards in places. You show your bags everywhere. Different society, you know, a different, you know, state of mind. So, you know, it depends on the culture and the society. But again, there's always going to be another way of getting in. I don't want to start, you know, giving out ideas on the phone or on the radio, but if you can't do it one way, there's another way to do it. So whatever security we do, a soft target is always going to be a soft target.
You know what scared me is that I was in Manhattan a couple of weeks ago for whatever reason. I've never seen so many people in my – I don't like going down. There was like thousands of people walking on the street with cell phones, not talking to anybody, just on their phones. And you don't know who they are or what they are. I went into the building, and the first time I went in, they asked me for my driver's license and, you know, ID. The second time when I walked out and walked back in, the guy just said to me, go ahead.
Well, and you know, we have with security is what's practical security, what works. And in this country, you know, when I do security reviews for private corporations and go in there, I always, you know, try to focus them on sort of the processes of security. But we're very visually oriented. We like to, you know, make it look like we're doing a lot. You know, for example, right after 9/11, you know, everyone said, we're going to start identifying everyone who comes in here. You know, I don't know how that would necessarily stop someone with a suicide vest. Phony IDs are easy to get. You know, if someone's going in there, you know, ready to give up his own life, what is showing the ID going to do? Maybe help the investigation after the fact. It's not going to stop a terrorist act. So one has
anyone
to decide, what is the reason? Now, there may be a reason for it. You know, certain places have an absolute, you know, basic need for knowing who's coming and going and tracking people, knowing who's in the building. But some of the places I were going, as you said, were these people who are half disinterested in what they're doing. You know, they're just security guards sitting there, you know, show me your ID. I don't know how that would deter what we're really afraid of. So when we talk about security, unfortunately, you know, we're very oriented. Oh, we have a lot of guards. We have a lot of cameras. We have a lot of this. And all that's okay. But if we're not backing up with true processes that work and true processes that are designed for that organization and what we're trying to protect against, then it's going to become ineffective. You know, just one, the best example I give now, you know, a corporation, you know, called me up, and this was years after 9/11, and, you know, one of the things they said to me is, all right, we have this big, gigantic fence, you know, it's motorized that we installed after 9/11, you know, it takes a half hour to open, a half hour to close, and now we realize what we're protecting against. You know, we're not a facility, we're expecting, you know, a car bomb. Doesn't mean it can't happen. I would never suggest that, you know, people should not do what makes them comfortable. But you have to do realistic security measures based on your facility, the risk, and what it is you're actually trying to protect against.
I know. There are some doctor's offices that I go into that you need to have your ID, and there are some that you just walk through the door. And there's some that know me and just say, go ahead. I mean, they shouldn't say go ahead to everybody, anybody. They should just do the same thing. They used to have actually parking attendants that stopped you to ask you where you're going to, and they don't do that anymore either. So the FBI is working with the Paris police to prevent this from happening. and there are so many different codes, domestic, FBI, CIA, and everything. How can these organizations work together to get this done as a unit rather than as separate units to keep the public saved?
Right, right. And again, and there are so, you know, so many threats, as you know, we discussed. ISIS is just one of many terrorist organizations.
Oh,
that,
God, they're
you
scary,
know, that,
yeah.
Right, the pros of that. You know, and again, prior to ISIS, we had Boko Haram, you know, who made the news when they kidnapped all those girls there. Al-Qaeda still has, you know, they're still a threat. So we're monitoring all those. We're monitoring the domestic terrorism. We still know there are people out there. We had a shooting now in Colorado. Certainly that appears to be politically motivated. When we guess, you know, again, we don't know everything yet, but that would probably fall on domestic terrorism. He probably had a political, you know, motivation there, trying to, you know, make a statement against private services of Planned Parenthood, trying to intimidate the population from not getting certain things to which they're allowed to get services. So that might fall into terrorism because of what the motivation was, not necessarily the act itself. You know, so we have all those. So you have police departments who just have to monitor the general day-to-day ingress and egress of people in their jurisdiction, looking for crime, you know, investigating the street crimes. And they probably have, you know, on a small scope, well, their own intelligence. But look at NYPD. They probably have an intelligence network second, you know, probably only bettered by the FBI. They have detectives out in, you know, all parts of the country, all parts of the world, rather, and they do their own intelligence. They're a small army, the NYPD. They do that. But at the same time, they work on the FBI Joint Terrorist Task Forces. Long before 9/11, the NYPD was, you know, there at the FBI office in Manhattan, working with us on terrorism, on bank robberies, and probably other task forces. So we have the task forces. Every city in the country now which has an FBI office has a task force, a Joint Terrorism Task Force, work together, sharing intelligence. I can tell you before 9/11, the FBI was working with the CIA to a certain degree. Those relationships have improved post 9/11. We're constantly revisiting the wall that we talk about, which is the separation of intelligence information from law enforcement. Because, again, there are rules on how we could monitor U.S. citizens. The same rules don't apply to foreign nationals. So the issue comes in, you know, what happens during intelligence operations that detect information on U.S. citizens. How do we pass it over to the law enforcement agency without violating, you know, their rights, without appearing abusive with what the intelligence agencies are doing? And a lot of those walls, by the way, that we structure were a matter of policy, not so much by law. It was just sort of a way of trying to, you know, keep everything clean. So, you know, we're still tangling with that, but, again, the walls are coming down a bit because we see we have to have that information. So it's a matter of the FBI working with the intelligence agencies, the FBI working with local law enforcement. Certainly, you know, the advent of telecommunications has made it easier for us to transmit information. Of course, technology can work both ways. You know, certainly, you know, as we know now, the terrorists use it to their advantage, but we use it to our advantage as well. So we are working closely with them. The FBI has to, you know, share information more. The intelligence community has to share information more. We share with our foreign partners. The U.S. is, you know, very closely embedded with several different countries that are our allies, and we'll share more information with them, with others. But there's always going to be some proprietary restrictions on information. You know, I know back from the days of the drug wars, you know, the FBI want to share information, you know, with the smaller departments. But, you know, everyone's concerned. What happens when the information gets in the wrong hands, vis-a-vis Snowden? Then the question is, how did the information get out? How come so many people had access to it? How come you didn't control it better? So, it comes down to another balance. We want to share information, but we have to always assure the security of that information, because then when it gets out or someone, you know, gives out intelligence information shared with us from another country, we have to explain how that happened. So everyone, you know, is still willing to share, but we got to be careful. We have to all maintain our own national security interests as well.
Should they ever have people in the FBI, CIA, or whatever, that are moles that are trying to get our intelligence and give it to the other give it to the terrorist groups? That's what's frightening.
Well, I haven't known. We certainly have had FBI moles. Yes, we've had agents arrested. As you know, the movie Breach was all about that.
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, that certainly has happened. I could say, fortunately, on a very small scale, in the last 30 years, I can only think of three instances of agents actually having that problem. Off the top of my head, there may have been more, but, you know, obviously they're not a lot. It doesn't happen often, fortunately. I'm not familiar with anyone having done it with a terrorist organization. They've done it with foreign powers, but I would suggest that as these foreign these terrorist organizations become you know, more slick at what they do, social media slick, you know, have the money.
Oh yeah.
They're going to figure out a way to start compromising federal agents, not on a wide scale. I don't see that as a huge threat. I see it as a potential threat. You know, I know now I go on LinkedIn and I see guys, you know, they're FBI agents. They give up the name, their picture, their position in the bureau. I don't know if that's such a great idea. You know, I understand why they do it. I don't know if, you know, putting that out there on social media for the FBI is really wise. To me, it's almost asking for trouble. So I think they need to be more careful in their use of social media, but because it just opens up doors. It gives out more intelligence than maybe we need to give out. But I think it's just a matter of time before, you know, an individual gets turned up. But I'm not worried about it on a large scale. Hello? Okay, Fran, I don't know if you hear me, but I don't hear you. I'm going to call you back, but I don't hear you. So please stand by.
Agent Mike Tabman, I don't know what happened with the sound. He's going to call me back, and let's hope we can continue the discussion on this. This is very, very serious because we don't want to be left holding the bag, and we want to make sure that everyone is safe. So I'm going to give him a minute to call me back and see what happens. I'm not sure if I can call him back. Can you hear
Hello?
Me now?
Hi. Yeah, I can hear you now, friend. I'm back. All right. I'm not sure how much you got
happened.
For me
this
on that one.
This is the second time that happened. I don't know why that happens with Blog Talk. But, okay, we have a couple more questions before Fran has to do whatever. So, what is the role of Syria, and what is the disposition of what happens with these refugees that are coming into our country? There's a lot of controversy about that.
Right. Well, Syria is sort of, you know, center stage of the problems right
yeah.
now. You know, we have the United States, its allies, and the rebels that we're backing trying to unseat Assad.
Yeah.
Russia, of course, Assad is an ally, so they don't want to unseat Assad. So we have this uneasy alliance because we're not really sure, you know, who Russia's fighting. And then, of course, we have ISIS, you know, claiming their
mm-hmm.
territory in Syria. So we really kind of have a mess that, you know, has to be worked out politically, militarily, anti-terrorism. There's just so many aspects with which we have to, you know, attack this problem, you know, diplomatically as well. So it's an unusual set of circumstances, this confluence of events. I think it'll be interesting
mm-hmm.
if ISIS does really push the United States and Russia to really cooperate against them. That would be a very, you know, tactical mistake on their part, if they really unite, you know, these adversaries, you know, sometimes uneasy allies. So we'll have to see how that falls out. As far as the Syrian refugee crisis goes, now I've never been personally involved in you know, vetting people coming
mm-hmm.
in under this program. But, mm-hmm. you know, from what I've read and whenever, you know, try to research here, it doesn't seem that program is a high risk for bringing in, you know, would-be terrorists. Everything's a risk. Everything we do in life, in international affairs, is a risk.
Yeah.
We can't ever deny that. You know, having embassies overseas, sending personnel overseas, we're always taking some risk. And, of course, we don't want to take unnecessary risks. So the question is, you know, do we need to do this? From the, you know, the few thousand people have come into this country, what I understand, no one has been identified as a potential terrorist. There's been many children and older people don't fit the profile, you know, of would be a, you know, attacker type of terrorist. There is a vetting process. I don't know if a would-be terrorist would want to go through that vetting process and bring himself to the attention of the State Department before he comes
mm-hmm.
to the country here. And this all kind of started with the belief that one of the Paris terrorists, one or two, had come in through the Syrian refugee program, but that has yet to be proven yet. But that is not conclusive. Mm. So we may be jumping to conclusions there. So, you know, I don't know that it poses this unusual risk. And people say, why do it? Well, you know, we are a country of humanitarian aid. We do that. But we also must remember something else. You know, terrorism breeds in certain parts of the country because of, you know, socioeconomic factors. Much like kids joining gangs, you know, in certain areas because of socioeconomic factors that contribute to that. You know, sometimes kids don't have many options where they are. Well, terrorism breeds in certain areas, such as we're in Syria. You know, corruption, crime, lawlessness. All right, you know, and it makes it easier to go out there and inspire and motivate these people to join these terrorist groups. So, what we want to do is sort of take away the chance of these people getting to these young, vulnerable people and creating more terrorists. So, by the world contributing by removing these families, these young kids from these areas which are prone to the radicalization by terrorist groups, we are sort of defeating them at the core by taking away potential for the terrorists and sort of making friends with people rather than enemies. So there is something to be gained for the United States and the world by taking refugees, those who want to come out and want to escape this, taking them out of this environment and settling them and making them, you know, maybe good citizens of that country rather than having them grow up to be enemies of the country and radicalized to want to do us harm. So, we have to weigh the balance. Again, could we guarantee that nobody coming in is a terrorist? No, and that was part of what the FBI director was trying to say. He can't personally guarantee that. Just that we can't really guarantee anything in the world. Very few guarantees can be made. But we have to look at it. Do we want to be a leader in humanitarian efforts in the world? Do we see a benefit of, you know, bringing these people out of these, you know, sort of terrorist-prone countries where these kids may grow up to become terrorists? And, you know, what is to our advantage? And everything is weighing it. And from what I understand now, of the few thousand that have come in, we haven't had that problem yet. But, you know, there are no guarantees. So it's a matter of this country deciding what are the pros and cons and where do we want to stand on the issue.
You know, what's frightening is that some of them, people are stereotyping people, which is bad. Second of all, they could be in the schools, they could be in hospitals, they could be anywhere, as we've seen before. So what are some things that the public should be aware of before they make a phone call and say, oh, my God, this person is whatever? What do you look for before you make that phone call to say there's something that shouldn't be there? How do you know?
Right, and that's a really good question, Fran, because, you know, when asked that question, you know, what do we look for, you know, what should we do, what could the public do to fight terrorism?
Yeah.
You know, my answer always is the old mantra, you know, see something, say something. So, you know, stay alert, we say, to your own surroundings. That's one for your own survival. Right. So if you're in an area, if you're in a mall, I always say, always know where the exit is. Just like on a plane, know where the exit is. If there's a mass shooting, the best way to survive is to what? Get out. Get out. Save who you can in the process, but get out. Escape the area. So know where the escape routes are. Know where there's an open door. You know, if you're in a mall and maybe if it's late at night, not all stores are open. You know what the last open door you just passed. Know where it is. We can seek haven. If you're sitting in a cafeteria area, again, know what you're going to do if there's a shooting. Where you're going to run to? Or where you're going to seek cover? Always have a plan in mind. So that's for your own survival. Then, when you're thinking about suspicious behavior, think about where you are and what would constitute suspicious behavior. So, you know, we've seen, you know, on planes, people are always watching. We're very nervous. You know, what people do, trips to the bathroom, you know, tugging at something under their clothing, you know, like the shoe bomber trying to ignite his bomb, you know, trying to get a match going. Clearly suspicious in a plane. No one's supposed to be doing that. But if you're in a mall, if somebody does not appear to be window shopping, are they, you know, looking at vents? Are they looking at other people and signaling? Are they asking questions that don't make sense? If you're at a some sort of, you know, hometown ceremony, like we have the lighting here, the Plaza Lighting in Kansas City, are they there, but they're looking somewhere else other than what you're looking at? You know, they're not sort of engaging in the, you know, the excitement of the event. We always talk about clothing, usually more in a warm environment. You know, if someone's wearing heavy clothing, you know, there's something looks suspicious. So you take all of that into account. And then, as you said, before you want to make the call, then think, is this really suspicious, or am I falling victim to my own prejudice? Right? Why am I really thinking this? Is it? Am I, you know, racially profiling? Am I profiling based on something other than really suspicious behavior? You know, is it just something about this person I don't like? And when I say our own biases, it doesn't necessarily mean racial bias. It can be biased towards anything. You know, someone's look, you know, or just something about them we don't like, or a clothing style. Mm. Is it really suspicious, or do we just not like it? And ask yourself that question. And if you can honestly say this is suspicious, then I say don't confront the person. You know, unless you see some imminent danger, so they don't tackle the person, assault them physically. Get a good idea of who they are, you know, meaning what they look like. You know, get a description, the face, the hair, color, the clothing, what they're doing that makes you suspicious, and where they are. And then a timely report, go to a police officer, or if you see a uniformed security guard. You know, it doesn't help if 20 minutes later you see a police officer, security guard, say, you know, down by that store there about a half hour ago, I saw some guy acting strange. Oh, really? What was he doing? I don't know. Just acting strange. What does he look like? You know, just average height, average weight, you know, brown hair. There's not a lot they could do with that. Okay? There's really nothing they could do with that. So, again, be specific. What do he look like? What was he wearing? What was he carrying? What made you suspicious? You know, give as much information as you can and give it timely. That's the important thing. And if you do that, have a question, one suspicious person, look at one suspicious package. You may stop one event. You may stop a series of events that might have occurred, such as Paris. Right, just by unraveling one tidbit. Remember what I said, it's not. We don't need to know everything. We need to know one thing, one starting point. And you know, law enforcement and the FBI, they're very good investigators. They know how to take that one tidbit of information and start spreading the spokes out and knowing where else to look. So if we can stop one person who was up to no good, we may stop a whole lot of things. So do all that. Look at it. Decide why it's suspicious. Timely reporting with specificity. That's the best we can do without becoming paranoid, without turning on each other, and going out and enjoying the day. If we don't go out and enjoy the day, then we've lost the battle.
Well, I did Black Friday. I won't say where.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't go into an indoor mall because there are too many people and not enough exits to get out. So I did it on an outdoor mall. So I was able to observe people walking around and feel, you know, comfortable. If I walked into a store and I wasn't sure, so I walked out. That's just me. But I'm one of these people from the South Bronx that I pretty much, you know, you have to be streetwise, but you can't be that streetwise. You don't always know. So what role does the media play? And do they create such hype that people get more afraid?
Well, that's also a good question. I work a lot with the media, and we always try to, you know, put a true picture of what's going on. Mm-hmm. The media has a job to do. Their job is to report the information timely, and to attract an audience. You know, fortunately or unfortunately, that's their job. So they're going to put out the information as it unfolds. The media, unlike law enforcement, is really not required. It doesn't have the same obligation to vet the information as law enforcement does. So they'll put it out there, and, you know, I know in the events I've been involved with, you know, that were high profile, you know, the media's asking me questions. Well, what about this? What about that? What about this person? We've heard this. And I can't comment because those are speculation, those people talking. We're not going to say someone might be involved when there's just no information to warrant that, or we haven't vetted that information. We're not comfortable yet. So it looks like, you know, the FBI is trying to avoid it, but we have no right going out there and saying things or implicating people that don't deserve to be implicated. So we have to be cautious. And the media has a moral obligation not to do that, but they also have the obligation, at least in the industry obligation, to report the information they have as it's coming in. Someone has said this. Someone has told us this. We have learned this. Some source leaked this information. I mean, they're not going to withhold that if it's newsworthy.
Yeah.
So that's their job. So I think, you know, just by reporting it, and then if several things happen at once, I think it does create a hysteria in the sense that we're bombarded with the scenes and the information, which is really not the media's fault. It is what it is. We do have this 24-hour news cycle, and we have many stations that do that. So we're hearing things over and over again. We hear new developments. You know, we hear information, things that happened that may not have happened, speculation. And we hear it so much that we can't really take fact from fiction. So I think it's a problem. But when I work with the media, usually they're pretty responsible in trying to get to the truth, trying to understand what the threat is. Many times, you know, especially in the last days since Paris, when they've come to speak with me, they've always said, let's not try to create, you know, unnecessary fear. Let's not go into panic mode. And then we talk about, again, like the questions you asked, what can we do to make ourselves feel better and more secure, but understanding the reality of the threat so we don't overreact, we don't start pointing the finger at people because of our own biases or things other than what's really, you know, a threat. So the media has a job to do. The talking heads, like myself, we have a job to do. We just sort of put a counter spin on it. But, you know, again, we're subject to this, you know, visual bombardment of our senses, you know, with terrorism, and it does make us nervous. So we all have an obligation to just kind of stop and take a breath and make sure we understand the facts before we make conclusions. But unfortunately, there are people in the media, not necessarily part of the media, but in the media, who will spew out facts and allegations without really knowing what they're saying, without knowing the truth.
Yeah, so I was just going to say, sometimes they're not accurate. And sometimes if you listen to different broadcasts on different channels, you're going to get different spins on everything. It's sort of the spin of the person that's giving it, yeah. Before we close, what are there's stadiums, there's games, there's concerts, there's just walking down the street or anything. And why is it that they usually pick holiday times? That's what's which is scary. They picked holiday times or specific, you know, times of the year to go, and we can't become complacent any time of the year. And I have to say this, you know, people disagree or agree with Obama, however he's running the government. To me, and it's just me, that he's the president of the United States, and however he's doing things, he's our leader. And that's all I'm going to say. You have to respect the people that are running the government, and you can't put them down. And there are other people that are, you know, working with him to tell him what he needs to do, what he doesn't need to do. And not everybody is going to be perfect. But there's stadiums, there's games, there's concerts. Why do they, you know, how safe is it to go to a concert or a game or a stadium and not have to worry that when you're walking through the parking lot that somebody's going to do something?
Well, let's, you know, go look back. Most of these events are private events. All right, so you go to a concert or something like that. You know, the FBI, you know, is not going to monitor this, you know, unless there's a specific threat of national security or terrorism that gives them reason. It's not the federal government's job to police these private events. The police departments may come out there if it's a crowd control issue, like, you know, such as, you know, maybe a Super Bowl, you know, which again would consider it a national, which by the way is a national security event. There are major events that would get the attention of the FBI, the Secret Service, and the local police, where we consider it high priority, you know, high vulnerability, such as a Super Bowl. But on your day-to-day events, you know, it's not for the federal government to monitor it, to police it. The police department will do it in terms of maintaining security, you know, smooth ingress and egress of the people, worrying about street crime. And most places have the police themselves, you know, security guards, metal detectors. That's up to them. How they decide their security is a private issue. So if it's not, you know, a major event, there's not a political figure there, it's just another soft target, and I don't mean that in a light way, that has no particular vulnerability other than any other soft target, then it's going to be up to that facility to provide for their own security. And in many jurisdictions, they can hire police officers off duty but in uniform. And I've seen that, which I got some issues about, but nevertheless, it does happen. So you can hire police officers. Now you've kind of bought yourself a uniform police presence, and they're there in their jurisdiction off duty, but with the authority of a police officer. And, you know, there's something to be said for visual deterrence, maybe not for a planned terrorist attack, but certainly for, you know, your general crime and some things that might have happened if they weren't there. We can never measure deterrence. We don't know how well it works, but there are studies to show that it does have an effect. You compare crime rates with different police departments, those who have, you know, high visibility versus those who don't. But you can do that. But in terms of, you know, stopping anything and everything, there's really nothing practically every soft target venue can do.
I know, and it's scary. You know, I have reviewed, I haven't even counted how many thousands of books, and there are so many books on terrorism, terrorist attacks that have been written. Are there too many? Could that be, you know, a seed for someone planting some idea? I mean, some of these books are so graphic and so visual that it's scary. The programs on television are like that too. And then you've got young kids that are impressionable, that are looking, oh, I want to be like that. I want to join that kind of a group. Or you have these kids that are actually think they're going up to heaven when basically they're going to be blown to bits, even though they feel that they're, you know, martyrs when they blow themselves up. So is there too much on too many television programs and too many books? I mean, the last 20 books that I've read have been on terrorism and murders, and I'm waiting for a happy book, people. Somebody send me something happy to read. And even kids' books deal with stolen paintings, this or that. Nothing. Nobody writes anything positive. Do you think some of it is because of what's being written, what people are reading, what they watch on television?
I'm not a great believer in that. You know, I think there's a lot of books on terrorism now because it is on our mind. And I think if people have an intellectual curiosity to understand, you know, the roots of terrorism, the history of terrorism, you know, which is why now, you know, I was asked to teach a class in terrorism college. Years ago, that probably wouldn't have been on the curriculum. So I think that's good. We understand it. We understand where its roots are and how to fight it, maybe, and to understand the threat versus, again, you know, what, you know, fact versus fiction. But, you know, crime has always been entertainment. Mm. I mean, police shows have been around forever. And, you know, if it's not a show about a cop, it's a show about a lawyer or a doctor. I mean, that's what the shows are all about. We like that. Police work, you know, is exciting. You know, we all grew up playing cops and robbers. But look, all the kids I knew, I grew up in New York like you did. All right, you know, tons of kids. I've been reconnecting with everybody, you know, over the years because of social media. But my point is, all of us grew up playing cops and robbers. I'm the only guy who went to law enforcement. So, you know, what did I say? So it's not like everyone was influenced, you know, by TV, by the games we played. You know, your passion chooses you. You don't choose your passion. And, no, I don't think that. And I think someone's going to, you know, no more be a terrorist than be a police officer based on what they see on television. It's going to be how their life unfolds, the influences they have, where they are at the time in their life. You know, as we said, there are certain seeds that will grow terrorism, socio-political issues, demographics, you know, all sorts of things that could, you know, sow the seeds of terrorism in, or criminality. And, you know, so it depends a little bit on your upbringing, your mental state. You know, certainly some people are more vulnerable to being recruited, just like into these cults. You know, what makes someone more vulnerable to that? You know, the terrorism group is, in my opinion, a cult, you know, of some sort. So it's a whole bunch of, you know, half part nature, part nurture, part circumstance, you know, luck or bad luck, all the things that are going on in your life at the time. Again, you know, when ISIS reaches out on social media, and we talked about that often, you know, and they radicalize, you know, here's someone here in the United States to try to pull off some terrorist event. Remember how many people are being reached by social media? We know we can't count it, but we know it's in the millions. But how many people actually take the bait? You know, very few. And fortunately, here in the United States, we've been able to stop it before they've done anything. But so, you know, it's out there. Everyone's exposed to it, but only a very small fraction of percentage actually are taken by it for whatever reason that's going on in their life or in their mind. And we just can't predict that, and we can't control that.
Well, you know, the only other thing that bothers me is that I won't say where they go to school. I have two nephews in college, and when I hear about a shooting in a university, I get nervous, really nervous. Then I start texting them, are you okay? Are you in your room? What are you doing? I mean, and they're in small schools that are pretty safe, but you don't know. I mean, look at
Well, you know, again, it goes down to what is safe. You know, really, what is safe?
Nothing.
You know, I live out here in Overland Park, Kansas. I mean, we have a very low crime rate. You know, I raised, you know, my boys are young adults now, but through the teenage years, I told them the good news is, you know, we have a very low crime rate. The bad news is you got a bunch of bored cops. So, you know, be careful what you do around here. You know,
that's what I'm saying.
You know, yeah, you don't want to get caught with drinking or the little things that, you know, when I was a cop, we used to, you know, really ignore. That it's not ignored around here so much. But they do a great job. I mean, the fact is we have a low crime rate. But the point is, Fran, last year, what did we have here? A guy by the name of Frazier Glenn Miller showed up and killed three people at two Jewish facilities. And he was just, convicted, and the jury recommended the death penalty. But, again, the same question is, quiet little city here, you know, very little crime, wonderful place to live. Doesn't mean we're safe from, you know, from one guy pulling out his gun and deciding to commit this terrorist act. So, you know, quiet area, it doesn't really, it means maybe I'm safer than someone in a high crime area on a day-to-day basis from the general crimes. It doesn't mean we're safe from anything happening.
Well, before I close, let me tell everybody that France taking off the month of December, and I will be back on January 7th. with Ann Traeger. She owns a company called Le French Book, and we're going to talk about how to translate from foreign languages into English. It should be interesting. On speaking of terrorism, Revenge Unleashed by Stephen Schwarzley on January 13th. And I'm doing it because he promised to make me an F-2 bomber fighter pilot in his third book. So I'm going to be a character in the book, so watch out, people. And he promised not to kill me off. Yes, I am really excited. You have no idea. And on January 19th, The Necessary Murder of Noni Burke. And that's scary when your child comes home and you don't recognize that it's really not your daughter, but somebody pretending to be. And what happens is frightening when somebody escapes a mental institution. But I am taking the month of December off for whatever reason. And we won't say why, because never mind. And Mike, before we close, tell everybody about Bad Intent, Midnight Sins, and where they could find out more about your great work. I'm waiting for the next one.
Oh, thank you, Fran. Thank you for asking. Well, Amazon.com, if you just run my name, Michael Tabman, T-A-B-M-A-N, you'll see my books. My most recent novel is Bad Intent. That is inspired by my years on the FBI NYPD Drug Task Force. We had very exciting years there, taking on the cocaine, the Colombian cocaine cartels, and the drug money laundering. And it's about an FBI agent, NYPD detective, and they're up against some unsavory characters in both their agencies, and they don't know who to trust while they're trying to fight this drug trafficking organization. And pretty good cop buddy story. And my first novel, Midnight Sin, is inspired by my years as a police officer, and the backdrop is a serial rape case, which I worked on also when I was in plain clothes. And it's also about a young cop who comes onto the midnight shift of a police department and really has to learn, the reality of the world, that, it's not the hard work that's going to get him anywhere, but the politics of police work, and he's up against corruption, guys he can't trust, his own ambitions, and his, his vacillating sense of right and wrong, as he tries to figure out how to make the case and how to get by in the police department. He's got a buddy partner who comes in from New York City, who's got his own way of doing things. He has a girlfriend who, likes him to do things by the book, expects him to be the straight-up guy, and he's trying to balance all these things. And you see him grow as a police officer as he takes on all these challenges and tries to solve this case and make his way in the world.
Well, maybe. Well, I am doing also, when am I doing it? We're going to do Hot and Steamy Wednesday on February 10th for romance writers. And on the 17th, I'm going to do a panel show with some authors. What villain in your book would you like everybody, would everyone like to come back, and even though they're gone? So what villain did you write about in your book do readers want more of, and why? And if your main character could write your next plot, what would the storyline be? That's just for February 17th. March 10th, we've got Brian Freeman. And I am absolutely flipped out yesterday. I received a book by Carl Brookins, The Case of the Yellow Diamond. And I turned over to the back cover, and I was quoted. So I was excited. That was the first. Yes, I mean, I've been quoted before, but by a famous author, I'll go, oh, my God, yes. So, Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you, Fran.
You're welcome, and I'm going to put the show out later again so that everybody that didn't listen, listened. I want to thank those people in the chat room that did listen. This is very informative. I want everybody to stay safe, stay vigilant, have a happy Hanukkah, Merry Christmas, happy and healthy New Year, everyone, and I will see you back on January 7th. Thanks, Mike, and have a great day.
Thank you, friend. You have a great holiday.
Bye-bye.